Hi, it's Ian Pickus. We are back in the Congressional Corner today with Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University. Tim, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here, Ian.
So, you know, this is our first time talking since the new president, the second time President Trump has taken the oath of office, obviously, and it's been a whirlwind in Washington the last few weeks. Broadly speaking, what's your view of how things have gone in the early days of this new era?
I mean, it's been very lively, we could say. It is interesting to think this through, that none of this should have been a surprise, and yet all of it, the pace of it, the volume of it, it still is staggering. The number of executive orders, the number of just policy declarations. And I think the country is still absorbing this. I'm not sure it's showing up in public opinion polling yet, and a lot has to play out, but it has been very striking. This is 100 days like no other. And it feels like 100 days, and we're probably only, about a third of the way there. But so much has happened.
What do you think the major impacts have been so far of the way he's running things?
A couple of things. I think wide swaths of the country are sort of on the back foot right now when you think about it. So state and local governments are wondering about funding for things like healthcare. Researchers have seen grants frozen or the process of reviewing grant applications halted. Educators are wondering what is ahead for the U.S. Department of Education. So to the extent that there are individual constituencies of each of these agencies out there, there's a lot of uncertainty right now. And each day brings a new wave of news about reviews or cuts or reversals of cuts. Just the widespread nature of the confusion is extraordinary.
What about the role that Elon Musk is playing in the administration? He's not an elected official. He's clearly a very close and top advisor to the president. I really can't think of a time when we've had somebody like him in a role like this.
No, it's absolutely unprecedented. Someone of such extraordinary wealth, and someone with significant amounts of business before the federal government, being given carte blanche by the president to gain access to payment records in the Treasury Department, potentially tax records for all Americans. There's never been anything like it. And it's very unclear how far this goes. Is a lot of this show? Will much of it be halted by the courts? Or is this a really radical transformation in the structure and reach of the federal government? None of those outcomes are off the table right now.
Now, you've raised an important question, and I don't think anyone really knows the answer to it, but they've already started talking about the possibility of ignoring certain court orders. And so what happens if the administration, you know, gets a ruling it doesn't care for too much and just presses on?
We have heard the term constitutional crisis tossed around among the pundit class pretty regularly since January 20th. But in many cases, it has been an argument that the Congress's power of the purse is being preempted. I think the larger constitutional crisis is just that. We've known since the founding that the judiciary is a passive institution. It doesn't establish an agenda of political of legal rulings. But the larger issue is, what do you do if you've issued a ruling and the government refuses to follow it? And so, as these court orders are issued at the lower levels of government, if they get appealed up through the appellate level and then to the United States Supreme Court, that's the real constitutional crisis. If the United States Supreme Court were to order the president to do something or rescind something or honor something, and the president were to refuse, then the founders would have said, "All right, Congress, step up. Here's your, this is your responsibility now. You've got one branch of government simply ignoring the checks and balances that we've built in, that being the executive, from another branch, the judiciary. Congress, this is your cue. You've got to do something to rein in the executive." And would a Republican-controlled Congress have the courage to do that? Right now, it sure doesn't seem like it.
Let's then talk about the opposition party. The Democrats obviously don't have many levers to pull, and there have been a lot of soul-searching conversations happening among the Democratic Party about messaging and their leadership going forward. Where do you see the Democrats right now as they confront this new era?
Well, they're just beginning to sort of lift their heads above the parapet here and begin to speak in terms of resistance, in terms of strategizing. From a legislative standpoint, it is true. They don't have a lot of power, but they do have some. And in the House, for example, the balance of power right now, the Republicans control 218 seats, the Democrats 215, two vacancies. The House has to approve a continuing resolution to keep funding the government by mid-March. The Republicans have never been able to do that without Democratic help. And with that slender a majority, the Republicans are going to need the Democrats to play ball. The Democrats are going to leverage that power as much as they possibly can to make sure they can push back against some of what the White House is putting out there. And then in the Senate, the Democrats, again, they're 47 seats, 45 Democrats, two independents that caucus with the Democrats, Republicans, 53 seats. Not a whole lot they can do, but they can filibuster. They can push for 60 votes to end debate and move on. There are two issues here. One is that the Republican majority could simply vote for a change in the rules and eliminate the filibuster. Whether they would be courageous enough to do that is anybody's guess. But the other is, if indeed it is a budget resolution, under some circumstances, it only needs 51 votes. And so people forget the Affordable Care Act got through as a piece of budget legislation when the Democrats couldn't muster 60 votes under President Obama. It's quite possible the Republicans could default to that if some of their big agenda items are stalled by a filibuster. So the Democrats do have some tools, and let's see how they use them. This is a time for really master tacticians in the leadership of the Democratic caucus in the House and the Senate.
Well, do they have that?
Chuck Schumer, he's taken some flack recently, for not being, what would be the right description? Assertive enough in the public sphere, pushing against the White House. But he knows the rules. He knows how to stall things. He knows how to slow things down. Hakeem Jeffries, this is where he proves himself as the speaker in waiting, as the minority leader in the House. He's got to leverage those 215 votes with the Republicans only at 218 and dropping down to 217 whenever the Senate confirms Elise Stefanik as ambassador to the UN. This is Jeffries' opening right now, from now until mid-March, to see what he can do to extract what he can for the Democrats in exchange for supporting a continuing resolution.
We've been speaking with Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University. Always grateful, Tim, for your time. And when we come back the next time, let's talk about some specific members of the Congress.
Look forward to it. Thank you, Ian.